Okay, so my first question for you, you know, we know that you've been having kind of a hard time at Red Onion State Prison, and we wanted to first ask, you know, can you share just what are the conditions there, how, you know, what's been going on with you? What would you like everyone to know about your conditions right now at Red Onion State Prison?
Well, yeah, left a commentary on Prison Radio podcast as well, kind of discussing about the entire situation that led up to me being back in segregation. But yes, yeah, so I came back here in segregation December 31st, 2021, and I have been here ever since then. Now, like 4 weeks ago, I got placed on the so-called release list, but 4 weeks later, I'm still, you know, in segregation in the hole. Obviously, beyond the time frame that I was supposed to have been in here for, you know. But yeah, prior to that, I had been in solitary confinement for 8 years straight, which was something brutal because I had seen these conditions of confinement drive people to pretty much to the abyss of insanity. I had seen even some of my peers basically commit suicide because the conditions of confinement and solitary confinement drove them to that extent. And currently the cell that I'm in, literally there's only a bed in here and a toilet. There's no desk. There's nothing for me to, nowhere else to put, for me to put my property. All my property is pretty much on the floor. And then the window, for whatever reason, it's like when it's really cold outside, I guess there's a lot of moisture that build up around the window, and then all of a sudden just like water tends to drip down from the window, and then it, you know, inevitably gets on my on my bed. So it's like I have to put toilet paper on the window to kind of soak up the water so it doesn't get on my mat. It's crazy, but, you know, these are the conditions that I've been putting up since December 31st, and I've been on the release since 4 weeks ago, but yet I still continue to be subjected to these conditions when I should have been released back to the general population 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for sharing all that with us, Pitt, and I'm sorry that you're going through all of that. And does it seem like, do you feel like there are specific reasons that you're being targeted?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, again, to make reference to some of my commentary previously and some of my articles, even some artworks, you know, it's, I think inevitably kind of goes, retaliation kind of really goes along with speaking out. And I think that's really a pervasive issue in a lot of different areas in life where, you know, if you speak up against certain structures and against, you know, certain mistreatment that, you know, other human beings are subjected to, you know, retaliation is basically the byproduct of it. You know, to try to break you out of it, to try to, you know, get you to shut up, to try to get you to go along with their program. You know, they will constantly try to throw the curveball at you and try to retaliate in, you know, different ways. You know, to me, segregation, being put in the hole, is not really just the one way of being retaliated upon. There's numerous of different ways that I'm constantly being subjected to some kind of shape or form of retaliation. Like, for example, back in, you know, when I came from solitary confinement after 8 years and I was put in general population, all I had to do was a year charge-free, do the programs, go to school, stay out of trouble for a year, and then I'd be eligible for a transfer. Now, I did that. Came out of long-term solitary confinement. I did a year charge-free. I did the programs, did the school, went along, and literally the moment that I reached that point of being transferred, the moment I come off my transfer, they do my annual review. They ask me what facility I wanted to get to, and I specifically tell them, like, you know, I'm trying to get close to, you know, where my family can realistically come and visit me, because right now I'm literally 6 hours away from my hometown of Richmond, Virginia. So, you know, I kind of picked, you know, facilities that would be close for my family to be able to come visit. And literally at that time that I'm eligible for transfer out of this region, I get sent to segregation. And they fabricate some charges to justify putting me in the hole. And while I was in the hole, I started protesting me being in segregation. And I received a lot of love and a lot of support from plenty of comrades on the outside, plenty of friends on the outside, some of whom I don't even know. But they started supporting me, speaking out against this situation that I was going through. And after a lot of public involvement and a lot of public interest in that situation, they finally told me that the real reason why they put me in solitary confinement was because they received some intel that me and somebody else had a problem with in the part that I was in. That's why they put me in segregation. Now, keep in mind, this other particular person that they referred to was actually somebody that I knew, somebody that I've never had a problem with the entire time I've known him. So I figured they was trying to basically justify putting me in the segregation, which ultimately derailed and messed up my transfer, which was obviously the intended goal, but they were trying to use him as a scapegoat to justify that retaliation and try to cover that and try to cover that whole retaliation up. But obviously, I could see through it. But you know, it's numerous of ways that I've been through retaliation. But you know, to me, that's definitely something that, you know, I'm not going to allow to prevent me from continuing to speaking out, because I think the more of us that do speak out, the more we'll be able to kind of change these conditions. You know, so I try to lead by example. So I definitely, you know, would not allow, you know, retaliation, you know, to be the catalyst of me, quote unquote, shutting up. You know, so no matter what, I'm always going to speak out against these kinds of tactics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you have so much support around you. You know, we're supporting you, and you know, any ways we can continue to amplify your voice, we're going to do that.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned a couple times your commentaries on prison radio. So for this episode, we're kind of highlighting the work of prison radio. And I wanted to ask you, how did you initially come in contact with prison radio and start doing your commentaries with them?
Oh, man. My fellow comrade, who is the Minister of Defense for the Revolutionary Intercommunalism Black Panther Party, named Rashid, he basically passed along that information to another comrade who was also a member of the party. And that information basically was passed down to me, you know, like, you know what, you'd be the perfect person to call this number, just kind of, you know, give the people an idea of what's going on, what people are being subjected to. At first, I had no idea what this was. You know, but, you know, it was just more so, it was portrayed to me like, you know what, people need to know what's going on. And when I first began communicating with prison radio, to me it was like, I understood its significance, because they were basically amplifying our voices. And this was really at a time where a lot of people were completely unfamiliar with the struggles that prisoners are subjected to. So I definitely understood why prison radio was so important, because a lot of times prison officials, they only respond to two things, public involvement or court orders. So those are really the only two things that will make them change their mind or, you know, change their policies or change their practices. You know, so I definitely I started, you know, leaving commentaries talking about what was going on, who was being subjected to what happened to this prisoner, et cetera. And the more I left commentaries, you know, the more I started to see the impact that it was actually having on overall prison conditions, because the more people started to know and learn about what was going on, the more people started to take the initiative to want to help in some capacity. And I've had people, a lot of people actually have reached out to me based on something that they heard on prisonradio.org or one of my articles or something to that extent. But, yeah, the information from the prison radio definitely will pass down to me from a trusted peer of mine. And I also pass it down to, you know, other prisoners whom I believe, you know, are capable of using the prison radio as the platform that we need it for. You know, make sure that, you know, this person, you know, is a thorough person, this person would not fold under pressure. You know, those are definitely the kind of individuals that, you know, we try to seek out so we can continue speaking out against these conditions, because, again, you know, those who speak out inevitably will be subject to retaliation. And, you know, I'm not going to be here forever. So it's important for me to try to, you know, help the next person, you know, step up to the plate and continue, you know, leaving commentaries and educating the public about what's going on in these kinds of places.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, we're super grateful to Prison Radio. They're comrades of ours, too. And that's how I learned about you and how we started corresponding. So we're super, super grateful for that connection with Prison Radio.
Absolutely.
I think you already spoke to this a little bit in your response just now, but can you share just like what does it mean to you to know that your commentaries are getting out there and that people are listening to them and responding and, you know, sending you messages, or what does that mean to you?
Oh, man. It means the world. It means the world. Because again, when I first got here, man, this place was really out of control. And it kind of seemed like, you know, I mean, assaults on prisoners being assaulted by guards while they're in handcuffs and restraints, strapped down and placed on ambulatory restraints for literally days, starving prisoners, depriving prisoners of their recreation, their shower. These were common practices that were very pervasive here at Red Onion. And it just seems like it was normal. It was normalized because to some degree kind of felt like nobody was listening. People did not really know what was going on. So it kind of felt like, you know, we were on an island. So when I started leaving commentaries and, you know, soon after, I started to see people responding to it, people being empathetic about our struggles. The more I continued to be vocal. To me, and it also kind of like highlights something that, you know, as a prisoner, you're kind of ostracized. A lot of people kind of like look at you or like, oh, you're a prisoner, you should be subject to that. But when people kind of listen to a prisoner's struggle and they have empathy towards it and they respond and try to reach out and help in any way that they can, that really kind of highlights humanity and why it's important. Because a lot of times when people are incarcerated, a lot of times they are treated as though they don't deserve humanity, they don't deserve dignity. So when you're incarcerated and people are reaching out, people are extending their hands, and people are basically empathetic to your struggles, it really makes you feel like, you know what, I might be locked up, but I'm still a human being. I'm still loved. And this is despite of the fact that, you know, everything inside these prison walls is basically designed to project onto us that we are not loved, we are not cared about. But when people, you know, do take their time out of their busy schedules to reach out and, you know, to let you know that we care about you, we're here fighting for you, et cetera, that is truly the definition of love. And, you know, inside these prison walls, love is really the closest thing that you have to freedom.
Yes. Thank you so much for that, Pitt. I'm so glad to hear that. I mean, we've got a lot of love for you, and we're fighting for you on the outside as best we can. So I'm glad that you're
likewise.
Okay. So I have a couple. I'm just trying to be mindful of time. This is great, Pitt. This is a really awesome interview. So I know you said you were going to send me an audio about your kind of your creative work. So I'm going to skip that question and go to the big one, the big question that I know you're going to have some real fire for. So, you know, that we're abolitionists. I know you know, we've had conversations about prison abolition, not just prisons, but prison industrial complex abolition. The question I have for you is, for you, for Pitt Panther, what does an abolitionist future look like? So if you could create a picture for us of what the future looks like without the prison industrial complex and without these, you know, these human warehouses, what does that look like for you?
Oh, man. Beautiful question. This is definitely a conversation and a subject that I've been very passionate about for a while. To me, a future after abolition to me is something that will pretty much bring the best of humanity to the forefront. I think to me it's like I believe that when abolition becomes possible, number one, let me say this, that a lot of people, you know, do not believe that abolition is possible. And there's also been a lot of conversation about, you know, abolition and revolution. What is abolition? What is revolution? Let me say that I truly believe that one really implies the other. But to me, I really think that the world without these human warehouses, the world without these exploitation, the world without oppression, again, brings out the very best of humanity. And, you know, it's not going to be there's not going to be a magic wand that would just instantly erase everything. But I do believe that these oppressive structures and the system that enables it must be abolished in order for us to get to a better place as a humankind, as human beings. Yeah, my bad. I'm looking at the time. But how many questions overall do we have left?
Well, I think I've got a couple more, but if we need to wrap up, that's great. I mean, we could try again on Saturday. The other questions I have for you are more about your art practice and also like kind of your political formation, your story around that.
I got you.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was afraid of, because I kind of looked at the time and I was like, oh, man, this thing's about to cut off. And I don't want to rush and try to wrap it up in the time. But anyway, I'm going to work on those tomorrow and then Friday, Saturday when we get the phone again. Hold on. Today's Tuesday. We get the phone again Thursday. So on Thursday, Thursday evening when I get the phone, I'm going to call you again and we'll pick back up on that.
Okay.
I actually wrote something about my art anyway, so that's definitely something we can just easily go over.
Okay, that sounds great.
But listen, Tina, the phone's about to hang up. I sent you something. Keep a lookout for that. I appreciate the love as always, and convey my love and solidarity to the rest of the familia.
I will. We love you so much, Pitt. Thanks for calling.
Absolutely. And Thursday, we will definitely pick back up on it. I think it will be right around this time frame, too.
Okay.
Thank you for using GTL.